Late Saturday afternoon, I crossed the tracks and drove slowly through Lowtown. The streets were alive with kids on bikes, pickup basketball games, crowded porches, music from the open doors of the honky-tonks, laughter from the men in front of the stores. Everyone was outside, sort of limbering up for the rigors of Saturday night. People waved and stared, more amused at my little car than my pale skin. There was a crowd on Miss Callie's porch. Al, Max, and Bobby were there, along with Reverend Thurston Small and another well-dressed deacon from the church. Esau was in the house tending to his wife. She had been discharged that morning with strict instructions to stay in bed for 3 days and not lift a finger. Max led me back to her bedroom. She was sitting in bed, propped up with pillows, reading the Bible. She flashed a smile when she saw me and said,
"Mr. Traynor, so nice of you to come. Please sit. Esau, fetch Mr. Traynor some tea."
Esau, as always, jumped when she gave orders. I sat in a stiff wooden chair close to her bed. She did not appear to be the least bit ill to me. "I'm really concerned about lunch next Thursday," I began, and we laughed.
"I'm cooking," she said.
"No, you're not. I have a better idea. I'll bring the food."
"Why does that worry me?"
"I'll buy it somewhere. Something a bit lighter, like a sandwich."
"A sandwich will be fine," she said, patting my knee. "My tomatoes will be ready shortly."
She stopped patting and smiling and looked away for a moment.
"We didn't do a good job, did we, Mr. Traynor?"
Her words were filled with both sadness and frustration. "It's not a popular verdict," I said.
"It's not what I wanted," she said.
And that was as close to the deliberations as she would get for many years. Esau told me later that the other 11 jurors had sworn on a Bible not to talk about their decision. Miss Callie wouldn't swear on the Bible, but she gave them her word that she would guard their secrets. I left her there to rest and went to the porch, where I spent several hours listening to her sons and their guests talk about life. I sat in a corner sipping tea, trying to keep myself out of their conversations. At times I would drift away and absorb the sounds of Lowtown on a Saturday night. The Reverend and the Deacon left, leaving only Ruffins on the porch. The talk eventually came around to the trial, and the verdict, and how was it playing on the other side of the tracks. "Did he really threaten the jury?" Max asked me. I told the story, with Esau adding emphasis when needed. They were as shocked as those of us who'd seen it.
"Thank God he's locked up for life," Bobby said.
And I didn't have the heart to tell them the truth. They were extremely proud of their mother, as they had been forever. I was tired of the trial. I left around 9, drove slowly and aimlessly back through Lowtown, alone and missing Ginger. Clanton seethed over the verdict for days. We received 18 letters to the editor, 6 of which I ran in the next edition. Half of it was devoted to the trial, and this, of course, stirred things up even worse. As the summer dragged on, I was beginning to think the town would never stop talking about Danny Paget and Rhoda Casselaw. Then suddenly, the two became history. Instantly, in the blink of an eye, literally in less than 24 hours, the trial was forgotten. Clanton, both sides of the tracks, had something much more important to fret over.